NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. On the night of March 31st, 2006, in Columbus, Ohio, an Ohio State medical student named Brian Schaefer went out to the bar with friends to celebrate the completion of his midterm exams and to kick off the beginning of his spring break. Brian was scheduled to catch a flight with his girlfriend to go on vacation 3 days later, but by the time the plane was scheduled to board, Brian was nowhere to be found. On the night Brian went missing, he was seen entering a bar called the Ugly Tuna on a surveillance video, and that was the last time anyone has ever seen him. It's now been 14 years since Brian's mysterious disappearance, and no one has ever found so much as a clue as to his whereabouts. But that's not for a lack of trying. I'm joined today by a Columbus native, affectionately known to his audience as The Captain. The Captain and his friend Nick host an amazing podcast called True Crime Garage, and for years, they continue to circle back to this case, hoping to find an answer. This is Season 9, Episode 3, The Case of the Disappearance of Brian Schaefer.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Captain, thanks for joining me today, buddy.
Yes, it's always good to talk to you, my friend.
Good to hear from you. And today we're going to talk about a case that's really interesting and intriguing to me. And I want to have you kind of break down the case for us, and we're going to talk some theories and things like that. It's the disappearance of Brian Schaefer. But before we get to that, I've got a couple questions I think a lot of my listeners want to know. Can you tell us a little bit, Captain, what is your background, and how did that background end up landing you making one of the most popular true crime podcasts in the world?
Well, I was a broke musician, and I was laid off, and Nick was laid off at the same time. And we used to hang out in his garage and drink beer, talk music, talk sports. But we always ended up talking crime because he wanted to talk crime with somebody, but he didn't have anybody really to, you know, just, let's talk serial killers. Okay, let's do it.
Right.
And my father was a detective. And so we just have always kind of talked about cases, or I'd hear about a case in the news and call him and ask him questions about it. So, but I went to school for audio engineering, and I used to produce records and toured as a musician. And so when it was like, okay, well, let's just try to record a podcast for fun. And yeah, at first it wasn't easy and it sounded bad, but eventually it was like, oh, I can actually use my schooling to make our show sound better and create music for our show. And where a lot of shows have maybe a music director, or they're paying a company to make the music, like everything from our show is created by me or Nick. All the music is created each week. It's created just for that case. So just a couple of unique things I think we do compared to some other shows. But yeah, but it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, you guys have an awesome production. And you guys got started about the same time that we got started, which was kind of before true crime podcasts were really cool. What year did you guys start, in 2015?
Yeah, we're a little bit after you, because I was a fan of Serial Dynasty.
Oh, that's right. I just had a flashback to the first time we met at the first crime con.
Yes, I had a good friend. So we started the show, and then I started meeting some people, and I had a good friend, Jess, that was a huge fan of yours. And she talked about you so much that I think I just became like a, a fan of yours just through her, you know, like I didn't know much about you, but she just always talked so nicely about you. And I was like, I can't wait to meet him. This is going to be awesome. But yeah, we met at that first Crime Con, and now I feel like we're like the OGs or something of the true crime world.
I know, it's weird, huh? Because when we go to Crime Con, you start seeing these new faces, and of course, you know, there's thousands of podcasts doing kind of what we do, popping up all the time. It's weird to think that something that, because you at least had some audio training. I know I was a fireman. I had no audio training. That we both kind of started this podcast on a whim, and now we're kind of the old salty guys that have been doing it for a long time.
Yeah.
So in that regard, what made you decide, there had to have been a conversation between you and Nick where you decided, let's make this into a podcast?
Well, so I would listen to shows because I traveled every weekend, you know, a few hours a week. And I was actually at a Thanksgiving dinner with my family, and I was just saying, I'm so bored traveling. And one of my cousins was like, you should check out podcasts. And I was like, what the heck's a podcast? So I Googled podcast, and the first thing that popped up was Adam Carolla. So I'd listen to Carolla, and then Nick always listened to, you know, Howard Stern and stuff like that. But then he got into like true murder, and so sometimes he'd send me these episodes to listen to. And so I just remember being in his garage, and he's like, we should do a podcast. And like, he kind of thought it out, and I was like, yeah, okay, what will we talk about? He said,
right,
true crime. And I was like, oh no, that seems depressing. But then he like had all these ideas. We'll have a beer of the week. I'm like, how does a beer of the week make sense with true crime?
Right.
But then he started telling me, I have catchphrases. I want to end every show with don't litter. I'm like, what does don't litter have anything to do with true crime? And so then we just decided that, well, let's record like a handful of episodes just to see how it goes for fun. And just to see if we could do it. And we recorded like, I think it was like six of them. And then we got in this huge fight. And we didn't talk for a couple of weeks. And then he called me up, and he's like, man, I really think we have something. We should release it. Because I don't think we might have done like 20 some, you know, we could have ended up doing 20 some episodes. We never talked about actually making it public. We just wanted to see if we could record it for ourselves, you know.
So you guys didn't have, at the beginning, did you have aspirations of, you said you were a broke musician. Were you guys hoping to make money off of it, or was it more just kind of a fun project?
Well, at first it was just, let's just see if we can do it. Can we even talk for an hour and have fun talking about a case? And I remember Nick saying, if I could make $500 a year, that would be awesome.
Right.
And I was like, this seems like a lot of work. for $500 a year. And then we, you know, like I said, he was laid off and I was laid off. And then it just became like, well, what if we could just make enough to buy, like, we both were really practical. So we just have regular cars or regular trucks, nothing special. And I was like, but what if we could make $500 a month? That could just go to us like both driving a cool car. He's like, that's right. We'll make $500 a month and we'll both drive cool cars. And then we started making that $500 a month, and neither one of us like drive that cool of a car. So, right. So, you know,
it's been such an interesting period. And we've kind of, you know, we weren't serial. We got in after that. So podcasts were starting to take off like this, but it was in its infancy. And, you know, when I started Truth and Justice, which used to be the Serial Dynasty, you know, it was just something I wanted to do, see if I can do it and see if there's people, you know, that want to talk about this case with me. And now it's kind of and then it turned into a career, kind of like it did with you guys. But then now that's all shifted. Like, now it's become so popular that, you know, I have people reach out to me all the time, like, hey, I have this idea. I want to start a podcast, and I'm hoping to, you know, quit my job and make a career out of it like you did. Everybody's kind of trying to go that route. And now it's become much, much, much more difficult to do it.
Yeah, I think it's a lot harder to get traction because people have their shows that they listen to. You know, I know a lot of fans of ours that listen to your show, and they might listen to My Favorite Murder, or they listen to Gen Y. So it's like they have their plate full. So when a new show comes along, they're like, unless you have some special thing about you, maybe you're a crime writer or maybe you're a former detective, maybe you have some unique voice that you can add to the space. I think it's really hard for new shows to get traction. I mean, we didn't start making $500 the first month. I don't remember how long it took to even, you know, see a dollar for the show, but it was, I know it was a long time. Like, you know what I mean? So it's like,
yeah.
When people, you know, I've had people, you know, make jokes, say, oh, well, I'm going to start a show tomorrow and start making money. I'm like, well, how about you just do it for a year, once a week for a year, and don't expect any money. And if you can get to that end of the year, well, then maybe you're doing it for the right reasons. Because most of the people that I know that are have been successful with the podcast, they didn't get into it for to make a career out of it. It's like, well, maybe this will be a cool hobby.
Right. Because it's easy to get burned out, you know, when you're with the, you know, you and I know doing it for a living, the deadlines are under all the time and, you know, the constant work. So, yeah, I think that's a good advice. If they can make it for a year and they still are enjoying doing it even without making money, then they probably got something.
Yeah. And I think the thing, too, is like you were saying about getting burned out. You know, we'll get done recording for the week and I'll be like, man, I don't want to hear another thing about a case. And sometimes that night, that night I'm like, I'm burnt. And then I made a pizza and I'm flipping through the channels. And next thing you know, I'm watching some 2020 and I'm taking notes going, oh, this is a fascinating case. I need to add this to the list. I need to learn more about this. So it makes no sense because I think there's just it's one of those obsessions, and you know, you just can't help yourself, which is okay though.
Right. And that's what, you know, same thing, it's a passion for me. You go through that process every week, the, as you said, Nick calls it, which is this, I think it's a good analogy. It's like a rat wheel where you got to, you know, research, write, record, edit, put it out. And then the next week you start it all over again. But every week, you know, it, like for what we normally do, or we're taking a deep dive into certain elements of a case, it never takes long for me to get reading before you're hooked back into it and you can't wait to do more and can't wait to put out the episodes.
Yeah.
And so this one today, I have one more question.
Okay.
About you before we get into the Brian Schaefer case. But you are affectionately known throughout the world as the Captain.
Yeah.
How did that nickname come to be?
Well, it's really funny because the last couple of crime cons, I got so tired of people going, you know, they'd be like, I'm Jessica. And then I got so tired of going, I'm the Captain. I felt like really, like I felt like that was just douchey. And so I just started saying my real name. And I also always said, if somebody that emails me or they send me a direct message, I'll tell you my real name. I'm not. But at first, when we started the show, just for fun, I was like, well, if it becomes something that we release, I probably shouldn't use my real name because I used to teach kids, special needs kids. I taught guitar lessons. I taught after school programs. And they're really careful about what you're putting out on social media or what you're putting out to the public. So I was like, well, I can't use my name because I would like to get back into that. And at the time I was volunteering at inner city libraries and helping kids learn how to use Mac computers and do photography or record music. And so I just was like, there was an Elton John record that I borrowed from Nick and I was giving it back to him and we're sitting there about ready to record. And he's like, okay, well, what's your name? And there was just this title, Captain Fantastic. And I was like, okay, well, I'll just be Captain Fantastic. And then I was like, well, I don't think I can be Captain Fantastic. So I was like, oh, I'll be Captain Fantastico. And I think we said that like maybe two episodes. And then I was like, we have to drop the Fantastico. That's so stupid. But what's funny is me and Nick have a really good friend that is known to every, well, he used to be known as the Captain. His nickname eventually changed, but so it's just funny when like my friends are out at a bar and somebody recognizes my voice and then they'll come over, "Are you the captain?" And my friends are always like, "He's not the, he's, nobody calls him that, you know?" Right. The funny thing about that though was the place I was interning, the library, they're like, "We have a couple of positions available. We'd like for you to apply." And I moved back from Indiana, so I had no job. I was just volunteering my time. And I was like, "Sweet, money, career." And the first question was, "So you're the captain on the True Crime Garage podcast?" And I never got a call back. They never told me if I, they didn't even tell me that the job was filled or anything. I just never got a call back. And I'm like, "Oh my, this podcast is going to ruin my life. And I'm just going to do it for fun."
Well, I think as it turns out, choosing the captain and the podcast life was probably the best decision for you.
Well, yeah. And but the funny thing is, normally when I meet somebody and I tell them my name, they kind of like look at me in disgust. Like, and then I had a couple ladies go, "You know what? I'm just going to call you the captain." I'm like, "You can call me whatever you want, you know?"
Well, I know your real name, but you should know that I have you stored in my phone still as the captain.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. And so, you know, but it's funny because my dad, for example, will constantly, "Hey, captain." I'm like, "So you're going to adopt this fake nickname?" And he's like, "You're the captain." So.
All right. Well, let's slide you into the captain mode and let's talk a little bit about the case of Brian Schaefer. You know, as I mentioned in our intro here, you know, during this time or during COVID when we can't get records requests, we're doing these kind of one-off episodes. And I'm trying to do a combination of cases that my listeners have told me they're interested in, they want to hear about, as well as cases that fascinate me that I want to hear more about. And Brian Schaefer is one of the latter. You guys covered it on True Crime Garage a while back. Can you give us, start out, just kind of give us the beats of the case?
Yeah, so we're Columbus, Ohio boys, and the campus of Ohio State, it's a big deal. College game days, well, a lot of it has been revived starting in the early 2000s. It was kind of grungy, made you feel like kind of like Seattle. You know, you'd be walking down the street and any post that you can post on anywhere had flyers for bands, and there was rock bars everywhere, and there's little dive bars everywhere. Well, this group called Campus Partners were coming in and tearing down these little tiny dirty bars and building these complexes. Well, in the early 2000s, they built this complex off of 11th Avenue, and there was a bar called the Ugly Tuna Saluna, which you had to go up some escalators, go to a platform, and then walk into this bar. And the bar was basically a square. It had a balcony that you could go outside for people to smoke and drink outside on the balcony. But anywhere in that bar, it was a square. So you pretty much could see anybody. And in the start of a spring break, it was March 30th or March 31st, 2006. Brian and his buddy meet up, and he's a medical student at Ohio State, and they go out for some drinks. They start at the Ugly Tuna. They have a couple drinks, but I think there's nothing happening there. So they're like, "Let's check out some other bars." Well, there's some other new bars in our arena district. So they get down to the arena district, which wasn't far, a few miles, go to a couple bars there, have some drinks there. He ends up making a call to his girlfriend. Him and his girlfriend, for spring break, they're going to go on a trip together. I think she was a medical student as well. And so he calls and leaves her a nice little message. You know, "Hey, honey, I'm thinking about you. You know, you're so gorgeous, blah, blah, blah. Can't wait to spend the week with you." Because she was up north visiting her parents before she went on this trip. So they come back to the Ugly Tuna that night, and it's Brian, his friend Clint, and their friend Meredith. And they're going up the escalators, and there's video footage of them going up these escalators. They get into Ugly Tuna. They start drinking. Then Brian's seen coming out of the bar on that little platform where the escalator would take you up. And you can see him on video footage, and he's kind of seems like he's tipsy or at least drunk. and he's flirting with these two girls, or at least talking to these two girls. Around closing time, there was a cover band playing that night. Around closing time, he tells his friends, "Hey, I'm going to go talk to the band." He leaves. They are now outside on the platform. I don't think the bar was letting Clint or Meredith back in, so they start I don't know if they're texting or calling Brian, but they're trying to make contact with Brian. He's not answering, so after about 5 minutes or so, they're like, "Well, we got to go." So they go down the escalator, go down the court. There was a courtyard, go into the garage, get into their car, take off and leave for the night, leaving their friend behind, thinking, well, maybe he was just talking to some girls, or maybe he left because he didn't live that far from this bar anyways. Well, then he just went missing. And, you know, after the first day or so of him not being in contact with anybody, people started getting worried. They started searching. Well, Monday, when he was supposed to hit this flight to go on vacation with his girlfriend, he doesn't show up. That's when it got real serious. But the short of the story is that he went into a bar, and we have video footage of him going into the bar. But as what the police say and what the FBI says is there's zero footage of him leaving the bar.
That's the part that is so baffling to me, is you have a place where there is actually, and there was quite a few cameras in the bar, weren't there?
Yeah. Well, what's weird is the whole complex that was being built, it wasn't completely built at the time. And so that's what kind of makes this whole thing a mystery, because some security guards say, yes, there was a bunch of security cameras up and they were all working. And I've talked to other security guards and they're like, yeah, we had some of the cameras up, but some of them weren't working. So you hear these, you know, both sides of the tale, you know.
Right. And there was only one way in and out of the bar, right? Or was there was a second entrance that went to out into a construction site?
Well, there was one exit for customers. So everybody thought if you're going to see him exit, it's going to be down that escalator.
And there was, and that's where the working camera was, where he was spotted going in, spotted at 1:55 a.m. where he was standing outside talking to the girls, and goes back in, but then he never comes back out that door.
Right. But what's interesting is, you know, this story, because I played in bands, but just if you went to bars around town, once he went missing, he was talked about a lot in bars. And even to this day, if you go, hey, you know that missing Ohio State kid? They're like, oh, yeah. And everybody has a story. They found him, right? Or I heard he went to, you know, Puerto Rico. You know, like everybody has a version of what happened to him. And I'm like, no, he's just, nobody knows what happened to him. It's a mystery. Which is strange. But one of the things that I've uncovered by going through the case with a lot of people is, one, there was two exits. And now, you know, the police will now state on record that they have footage of the back exit way. Now they claim that he's not on that footage either. But for a long time, they didn't even talk about having the actual footage for the back hallway. I've never seen it. They used to play the footage of the escalator footage all the time on the news here. And I believe at one point, Columbus PD set up a website that you could watch closing time. It was like 30 minutes, you know, closing time as they herded everybody out of the building. But on that escalator platform, which is kind of scary, is you see all these people leaving down the escalator, and there's three Columbus PD right there.
On the night that he disappeared?
Yeah, on the platform, watching the kids go out of the bar. So once we found out that there was a back entrance way and that there was video footage, we've requested this footage. We've never received it. I wanted to send it. You know, you worked with a production team on your, you know, amazing coverage of West Memphis 3. I wanted people that worked in that field to take a look at the footage.
Mm-hmm.
They're trained to see, oh, in this shot, your top button was buttoned. We got to make sure it was buttoned in this next one. Get people that know what they're looking for to look at this footage, but also like just some weird stuff happened. He goes missing. Everything on Google is about Brian Schaefer. Well, because it's through Ohio State campus, they don't want the first thing when you Google Ohio State campus to be about a missing kid. So all that stuff gets shut down real quick. Then it starts becoming hard to find any information about the case. And then the bar itself, the Ugly Tuna Saluna, had, you know, like online, you know, this band is playing this night. These are the drink specials, like your online schedule. And to this day, you can find, you know, months before then and months after, but you can't find the calendar of that month that he went missing. And it's like, why are you trying to hide that? And for years, nobody knew who the band was. And I'd be playing in gigs and I'd say, hey, man, do you know anybody that played the Ugly Tuna? Oh, yeah. So-and-so's band played. I'm like, did they play the night Brian went missing? Oh, no, I don't think so. And it took years. And it was actually a guy that did a little, did some episodes on the case. His name is Nicholas West. He contacted me and said, I think the name of the band was Rock House, which happened to be a popular cover band in town, but also happened to be three guys that I grew up playing with. So I was able to call those guys and say, you know, get some more information that was never released before.
So what did you find out from them? Did they remember, you know, his friend Clint said, didn't he say he was going back in or said he wanted to go talk to the band?
Yeah. So, you know, there's two stories. One was I need to go to the restroom or I'm going to go talk to the band. Brian was a huge guitar fan. He was also, you know, a guitar player. I don't think he was the greatest guitar player, but I think he was trying and it was definitely a hobby of his. And he had a Pearl Jam tattoo on his arm, really into Pearl Jam. And my buddy in Rock House was probably one of the best guitar players in Columbus. So for him to, all night, he's a little drunk, flirting with some girls, but he keeps seeing this awesome guitar player. And at some point, he was probably like, hey, I want to go talk to that guy. Now, my buddy that played guitar does not remember talking to Brian that night, but does remember that the band had probably maybe, let's say, 15, 20 people there to watch them, and they're all going to go hang out afterwards. And one of the girls got into a confrontation with a drunk guy at closing time. Now, nobody in that group can confirm that it was Brian, but they can confirm that it was a male and that, you know, a skinny male, drunk. And she just, you know, I think he was kind of being handsy or whatever he was being. And she kind of, you know, said, what the heck are you doing, man? But what I can confirm from the guitar player, the bass player and the drummer is they all three left through the back entrance way or exit way. That's where they took their gear. But all their friends as well left through the back exit. And multiple employees of the bar left through the back exit. So is it possible that Brian left with them through the back exit? I believe it's so. Now we have no solid proof of that, but I think it's less of a mystery. I think when people talked about this story before, it was a man walks into a bar and there was no way he could have ever been not seen on camera, you know, leaving the bar.
Right. But well, what do you think about the fact that the police are saying now? So they're officially saying now they do have footage of the back door and he never went out it.
Well, they claim that he's just not on it. And again, I think like it makes me question how much footage they have from inside the bar, because if they have footage of some form of inside the bar, can't we track him? Isn't there a way to track him through the video?
Yeah, it seems weird because what I was reading was that there were several, like you said, maybe that's not all accurate, but it seemed like there were several working cameras inside the bar. And it seems like, why do you only have him outside? Why don't you see what he did when he went back inside?
Yeah. And it's just so interesting to see how the story has changed year after year. Just like, for example, you know, so Clint and Meredith left and everybody has kind of suspected that, you know, maybe there was some foul play and that his friend was involved. Like, why would you let your friend, why would you leave your friend in the bar?
I've totally left my friends in a bar.
Well, he didn't live that many blocks away from the bar.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you saw your friend that has a girlfriend. Now, when he went missing, everybody said that was her fiance. They were never engaged. And then everybody said, well, he was going to get engaged. He was going to propose when they were on their honeymoon. Or not the honeymoon, but they're on their vacation. He never bought a ring. We have no evidence that he was going to buy a ring. So it's just a narrative that was created.
Mm-hmm.
And even like when people said, oh, he looks drunk on film, his dad got mad about that. Oh, he wasn't drunk. He wasn't. And then this girl, which has been very nice, has talked to me multiple times. She ended up putting, I think, her number in his phone. So exchanging numbers with Brian. And she was one of the girls that was out on the platform that he came out and was talking to a couple minutes before closing time. And I believe the story for that was he was supposed to go home with them, and, you know, they kind of looked for him, didn't see him. And then they went to their car and waited for just a little bit, and he never showed up. So then they left. Well, when you say that story, you know, his father has since passed away, but instead of taking that as evidence, his dad would just be like, my son didn't flirt with these girls. They must right. be drunk. They must be drunk. They must be whores. And you're like, what? Well, wait a second. We have evidence. This video footage of your son stumbling around. We have his friend Clint and his friend Meredith saying he was drinking heavily. So, but I think that happens a lot of times in a murder case or a missing person case where they're like, this guy would light up the room, you know?
Right.
This guy was friendly to everybody. This guy never overdrank. So the story has kind of kept evolving over time.
Do you know when you spoke with your friend who played in the band that was playing that night, did he say, did police ever question them?
Yeah, they were questioned very minimal. And early reports, if you can find stuff on YouTube about, you know, Ohio State student goes missing, they talk about thoroughly investigating the scene, thoroughly questioning everybody that worked in the bar, and thoroughly questioning the band. And I don't think they thoroughly questioned anybody, but I do know that they were questioned, and in the cops' mind, they were ruled out. Because one of the big theories for the longest time was, well, I think he hung out with the band, and then something happened, and then the band knocked him out and put him in a case, you know. Now, I've been playing music for years. There's not that many cases that you're going to be able to put a 6-1, you know, guy into.
Well, and typically on sets like that, any case that's that big is that big because it's full of stuff. So if you had a person in there, then you'd have a bunch of stuff without a case.
Right. Yeah. So unless they were playing in this all along and they brought a separate case to put a body in. But like I said, I've known these guys for years and played on records with them, played in bands with them. They're just not those guys. I mean, the guitar player was, when he found out one, oh, you have a podcast. He didn't even know I had a podcast. He was excited for me. Oh, your show is, you know, somewhat successful. And he's like, you know, yeah, I was there. And he's like, but it was no big deal at the time. And I was like, well, do you remember talking to him? And he's like, you know me. If you don't have... This is what he said, not what I said. He's like, if you don't have tits and ass, I don't care. And that was his reply to me. And I was like, well, Brian didn't have tits or an ass. Well, maybe he had a little bit of an ass, but so you know, this guy was an amazing guitar player that people came up to all the time and was like, hey man, great show, or I love your guitar playing. So is it possible that Brian shook his hand or said something to him that night? Yeah. And I really think it's most likely this small group of people that were leaving together to go to a party, and they get into a confrontation or a small little confrontation. One of their female friends gets into with this unknown guy. I really believe that unknown guy was Brian.
It certainly makes sense. It's a hell of a coincidence if it wasn't.
Well, and the guy that played guitar, he was a couple years older than me, but when I started playing gigs with him, he was very, you know, very meticulous. The way he would load his gear in and the way he would load his gear out had a system every place he played. And he had this black Ford Explorer, and he would always pull it around, you know, to the alley or somewhere close so he didn't have to carry his stuff that far. And so what he can remember from, you know, now it seems like 20 years ago, but it's a little less than that, 14 years ago, is he remembers pulling his car around. He remembers what alley he pulled into, right where there would be some supposedly cameras, which police have never showed those cameras, because why not show the cameras that show the band loading up? If there's some suspicion that the band knocked this guy out and put him into a tub and carried him out, why not show the video footage of the band loading their instruments in? I don't think there's a camera there, even though they claim there was. Why not show it? But what my buddy was telling me and what the other bandmates were telling me is if they did have that footage, you would have seen 30-some people that left through that back way, you know, and that was just not discussed for years. I mean, heck, for a long time, there was no discussion of there even being a back exit way. So it's just one of those, like, you know, rumors, guy walks in the bar and never seen again. And it's like, as the story unfolds, there's a lot more to it.
So was the door that went out to the construction zone, I think it was down at the bottom of the escalator, is that then a third door out of the building, or is that the back door?
So yeah, the back door, basically there was a path, my buddy said, you know, where they had a, you know, maybe the flooring wasn't completely done, that they had, you know, like sheets of plywood just like down on the ground to protect whatever they're, you know, so there was like a pathway, like almost like the pathway wasn't even done. It was still under construction a little bit. So that's another thing. People were like, well, did he walk off the construction path and, you know, fall into some cement, or did he fall into some wall and did they close in that wall or whatever? I think it wasn't as under construction as people believe. It was almost 100% completely done. It was just that pathway was a little bit of a construction zone, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, and the fact that neither he alive or his body have never been found in 14 years, in my opinion, pretty much rules out that something accidental happened, that, you know, he wandered off in the wrong place or something like that. I mean, what do you think about that? Do you think there's any possibility that this was just some horrible accident?
Well, no, I mean, it very much could be, but once he gets outside, you have the idea that he has to go a few blocks, and he's going to go into a few blocks where it's not, yeah, they were trying to revive the area, make it nicer, but it wasn't the best area. It's not an area that I particularly feel safe walking home, you know, the amount of blocks he had to walk home. But the story always changes, and it's so funny about who wants to control the narrative. So Clint and Meredith, they go back. Here's what's interesting about them. They go back to, Clint was house sitting a condo for a teacher. He was a TA. So they have video footage of him leaving the parking garage with Meredith, right? And then he had to type in a certain code to get into the condo complex. So if you roughly estimate how long that drive would have taken him and Meredith, we can tell that he didn't stop anywhere. They didn't stop to get food. They didn't stop. They didn't run into Brian and kill him and throw him into the woods. They didn't have time. From the time they left the garage to the time they got to the condo, it's almost like every second's accounted for. He takes Meredith back to this to his teacher's condo. They spend the night there. The story for 10 years, and still from some people to this day, and I get shit on all the time about this, was Clint and Meredith wake up in the morning, and I believe Clint's car or Meredith's car, one was parked at Brian's apartment. So the story for years was that Clint and Meredith went back to Brian's apartment to get into the car, you know, drop off the person to their car. But instead of doing that, they went into Brian's apartment, and they were actually in Brian's apartment for a few hours or so. That story is completely a lie. They went back to Brian's apartment, didn't really think much about the fact, you know, that they lost him that night. And, you know, Meredith got in her car and Clint got in his car and they drove their separate ways, you know, taking showers, eating lunch, doing whatever. And then they met up later that night to hang out. And that's when they're like, it starts becoming, well, Brian's not, you know, responding to my calls and blah, blah, blah.
You know, speaking of the calls, that was something that was interesting from what I was reading. It seems like there's a lot of misinformation out there. Is it accurate that I don't know, was it Meredith or Brian's girlfriend that kept trying to call him every day and it would go straight to voicemail, and then one day it actually rang and they found out that it pinged a tower like 14 miles away from where he disappeared from?
Yeah, so yeah, that was his girlfriend. At the time, she would call pretty much every day, and then one day it rang. Now, I don't actually think it was that call that pinged, but eventually when they did do looking for pings, they found a ping in Hilliard, Ohio, which would have been, you know, probably about 10 miles away or so. But that could have just been a fluke, you know?
Right.
But the reason why I bring up the Meredith and Clint, the reason why I bring up the fact that they claim that they never went into Brian's apartment is because out of all missing person cases, this one, when I talked to police officers and detectives that covered this case, I get this weird suspicion that they believe he's alive. And I've had, and I don't want to give up sources, but I've had people say, he's not dead. People that I find credible.
Saying that he's not dead as though they know that he's not dead.
Right. Like they know that he's not dead, but they can't prove it. And when it's an adult that goes missing, they have no, they could find the guy. Their only duty to society is to close the case. Now, so we know that they don't have definitive proof that he's alive because they would have to close the case, if that makes any sense.
Right.
So they don't have to tell the family members. They don't have to tell the public, but they do have to close the case. They have that obligation. And well, at least in most departments.
Do you think he's alive?
Well, here's why I bring up the Clint and Meredith story. It's because a lot of people go, okay, well, there was reason to believe, you know, Brian's mother recently died. He had some difficulties with a relationship with his father. A lot of people believe because Brian 2 years earlier looked like this rock star, always talked about just being in a band and just touring. And he was really into Eddie Vedder. And there was rumors that Eddie Vedder was writing the music to the Alexander Supertramp story called Into the Wild, about a kid that disappears and starts a new life and goes off to find himself. And Brian was a mama's boy and was having a really hard time with the fact that his mother passed away. And a lot of people said that he didn't want to be in medical school, that he was doing it just to make his mom and dad happy. But now that she passed away, he was like, why am I doing this? But here's the reason why I bring it up is because when people say, oh, Brian went off and started a new life, right? You go, well, who decides at 2 o'clock in the morning, piss drunk,
right,
that you're going to leave and start a new life and decide, oh, by the way, I got to get out of this damn bar without the cameras seeing me, because that'll be a good ruse.
And he also had the plane tickets for the next day to go on vacation.
Well, he had the a couple days later. Yeah, yeah. So I think there was 2 days in between, and then he was going to go. But what I think is interesting, or more interesting, is so his friends leave him. Let's say he gets out of the bar just undetected. He gets back safely to his apartment, falls asleep, then wakes up, and he's still having these thoughts about starting a new life. Well, he doesn't know that the cameras didn't pick him up on that at that bar. But if he's going, hey, I got to go now. If I don't go now, I'm going to have to go on vacation with my girlfriend and maybe she's expecting me to propose and I don't want to do that. Well, now I'm out of here. It's possible. But there's a lot of people in the Brian Schaefer community that get mad at me because they say, no, Clint and Meredith went into that apartment and they know for a fact. But I've just heard otherwise by credible sources. Brian's father hired a private investigator. I've talked to him extensively about different things. And that's the other thing, too, is Brian's father was unabashedly saying Clint was responsible for his son going missing. And, you know, he hired a private investigator to prove that. That's strange to me. It's strange to me that you wouldn't admit that your son might have drank too much. It's weird that you would call these girls names for just talking to your son. That's odd to me. But if I went missing, my mom would tell you one story and my dad would probably tell you the real story, you know?
Right. Same with me. Yeah.
Yeah. My mom would be like, he lit up every room. And my dad would be like, he turned out all the lights. He was a son of a bitch, you know? You know?
Right.
No. And so there's all these far out there rumors about him. But one of the reasons why a lot of people believe that possibly he passed away was his dad died in this. We had this crazy windstorm and a handful of people died in this windstorm. And his father was one of them. So people thought, well, if Brian went missing on his own, maybe he'll come back for the funeral. Well, there was a funeral home will have a little message book to sign online. And there was a odd, you know, like, I miss you, Dad, or I love you, Dad. And it was signed like Puerto Rico or something. The cops claim that they have figured out that that was just a hoax and that was done at a public library with inside Columbus. So it wasn't done from some island. But that's that little bit of information really sparked the idea. Oh, this guy might be alive somewhere else. I don't know. I think it's most likely that he got outside the bar. We just don't know how, or we just don't have the evidence of that. And there was some foul play between the bar and his house.
To me, that seems like the most logical, you know, of course, I haven't done obviously nearly the deep dive in the case that you have, but just from what I've been reading and from what we've been discussing, yeah, I think you make a really good point about deciding at 2 a.m. while you're drunk to start a new life and executing that plan with flawlessly where no one can find you. It seems very unlikely. It seems much more likely to me that someone got a hold of it.
Right. But that story only makes it less plausible if Clint and Meredith went to his apartment. So then that shortens the time period. So they go to the apartment. He's not there. They're there for a couple of hours. He never shows up. Oh, if he went to start a new life, that means he did it the night before. Well, if Clint and Meredith are telling you, hey, by the way, we didn't go into his apartment. We don't know what you're talking about. Then the time period becomes a lot longer. Nobody was in his apartment, I don't think, until later that night or the next morning. So is it possible that Brian got home, slept off the night before, and decided, well, I'm going to take off? And he would have had hours upon hours to do so. I don't know why you'd leave your car behind. I don't know why he would leave his guitar behind.
Yeah, and I don't know about you, but after a night of drinking like that, I'm not usually the most energetic the next day to put something like that into place. I'm more likely to lay around.
Yeah, and so I'm going to talk about something that's strange here for a second. I'm not in love with the idea of psychics. Or like tarot card readings or anything like that. I know detectives use them from time to time. And my father has talked about that when he would get to the point that he would use one. And he said that sometimes it was just that you could present, you know, you could just present a picture or whatever. But they might just tell you something that sparks an idea that you just didn't think about before. So he always thought like, what do you have to lose, right? And I know Brian, and I know a lot of missing person cases where they've tried to use psychics and stuff before. But there was a show called Psychic Kids, and they took him to the Ugly Tuna Saloon. And so, like I said, the quick timeline is Brian and Clint went into the Ugly Tuna earlier in the night. They had some drinks, went to a couple different bars, and they came back, right? That's important. So these psychic kids are at this location, and they have this adult mentor, right? And one of the psychic kids say, I have a feeling that he was here and left and came back. So what the mentor, what their adult mentor said was, oh, well, good for you. Because Brian went into this bar up the escalator, was in the bar for a little bit, and then stepped out onto this platform to talk to these girls, and then went back in the bar. And that's probably what you're feeling. And I kept on thinking, no, you idiot. He's probably thinking Brian went into the bar like earlier in the day, went to a couple bars, and then came back. But that kid, that was not highly reported before. It wasn't reported often that he was actually in the bar earlier that day. It was just, oh, he went into this bar and, you know, that happened. But I just thought, wow, that's really interesting that this kid picked up on something and his adult mentor is not even explaining it to the kid right on what he picked up, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But multiple kids in that scenario claim that there was somebody watching him all night. And I have always felt, here's this good-looking guy. It's the start of spring break. If there's a predator for this type of individual, where would they go? They're going to go to campus. They're going to go to campuses. We see this all the time. People talking about the smiley face killer theory. You got all these Charlie projects. You got thousands of guys in their 20s that have gone missing. I think there's a certain type of predator for that. And I think this guy, I think Brian was pretty drunk. And I think he was maybe a little cocky, a little arrogant. He was going up to women and just talking to them. And I think there was some, and this is what the psychic kids have felt. They said there was somebody watching him. And I believe that whoever was watching him was jealous that they couldn't be that type of person. You know, oh man, this guy, he's good looking. He's this, that, he's flirting with women, and they become a predator for that type of individual, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Wasn't there also a psychic that said something that told the father something about that Brian's body was thrown into a water somewhere?
Yeah. And there's a, you know, a big river, pretty close called the Scioto River. His father looked, a lot of people looked in that area. And I think at one point it was almost drained because they were doing maintenance on it. But his body was never found. And also, just like if he would have left the bar, even if he was drunk, unless he was trying to head to somebody else's house, you know, maybe an ex-girlfriend or maybe just a girlfriend that he had hookups with, because the river wouldn't be in the direction. He wouldn't have to pass the river to get to his apartment.
So before we wrap things up, Captain, is there anything else you want to say about the case?
Well, I just think it's really fascinating that when you're diving into these cases, don't always take what you see in a paper or what you hear as 100% gospel. Because especially in this case, the more that time goes by, the more I find out things are not the way people were trying to make them appear.
All right. And then if anybody else wants to hear more about the case, where in the True Crime Garage catalog can they find your work on Brian Schaefer?
We've talked about him a few times. And if you just go to Stitcher, you can. All of our episodes are available on the Stitcher app for free, all the way from episode one to now. And we covered him really early on because it's such a popular case in Columbus. But we've done follow-ups on it as new information comes out.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. produced and edited by Mike Bussing and sound engineered by Shane Yoder. All music for the show was created, composed, and scored by PutThemInASong.com, who also mixed and mastered this episode. All of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Charlena White, Kay Wood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, and Jen Reese in Candela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels. For just $5 a month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes videos of the creation of our Friday follow-up episodes that always include 10 to 30 minutes of pre-show bonus chat. Other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. To become a patron, just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. And I personally can be found on social media at Bob Ruff Truth, and Mike can be found at Murb Gaming. MURRBGAMING. Don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.
The Ford Ranger, a vehicle for all terrains and every passion. It's a workmate, a playmate, and to its drivers, a soulmate. So how do you improve the Ford Ranger? You go all in. The all-new Ford Ranger, the UK's best-selling pickup. Now available with rear bumper steps, tailgate workbench, and enlarged load box that can fit a Euro pallet. Go break it in. Search all-new Ford Ranger. Ford Pro. Driving productivity. According to SMMT data, features may be optional extras with additional cost.